Delighted to welcome to the programme David Burke. David, good morning, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Joe, and I'm equally delighted to be on the show.
Excellent stuff. Now, we're going to talk about your book, which it comes out, if I'm not mistaken, on the 5th of this month. Is that correct?
Yeah, hopefully on the 5th, yeah.
And it's
all the lorries are working still and all of that.
Oh, my God. And just pronounce it properly for me, please.
Yeah, Kitson's Irish War.
Irish War. So tell us a little bit about the book, about the man himself. Now, I've done a small bit of research. He was a well-travelled man in the British Army, that's for sure.
Oh, he certainly was. I wrote the book about him because I think he's probably one, if not the most important, of all the British soldiers who came to Ireland during the Troubles. And he was really, even then, he was really a man out of time. He was born
yep.
in 1926, and he was from a naval family, and they had 200 years before him of unbroken service in the Navy. And he went to one of these very posh schools called Stowe. Stowe is like Eton, but it was geared to taking in young men and turning them out so that they'd join the military, the Navy. They'd go out and they'd rule the empire on behalf of the monarchy for Britain. And he took to this life, and he took to this school like a duck to water.
Mm-hmm.
He became the head boy in his school, and he became interested in blood sports and all the rest of it. But much to his dismay, Joe, when he tried to get into the Navy, he failed because, you see, he had asthma, and instead he went into the Army, and he made a huge impact on that. Now, skip ahead, if you like, a little
yep.
bit. He eventually rose up to become the commander of land forces, which is one of the most important, highest-ranking positions in the Army. And he had he also served as the Queen's aide-de-camp. And that's not a very time-consuming job, but it's one that's of huge significance to soldiers in the British Army. It's a great honour to bestow upon somebody.
Mm-hmm.
Now, people in Ireland who were around during the pivotal events that we've been learning so much about in recent times, like the Ballymurphy massacre and Bloody Sunday, and the 50th anniversary, of course, of Bloody Sunday is coming up early next year, next January, they'd have a different view and a different take on him. But, Joe, do you remember when I said he was a man out of his time?
Yes.
Before, and you said he was well-travelled, and that's absolutely correct, before he came to Ireland, He was in the Army. He just missed the Second World War, but he spent 5 or 6 years in Germany after the war. But his true vocation found him when he was sent to the colonies. So in the early 50s, he went to Kenya. And Frank Kitson has written an awful lot about this, and his writings are still available. And in today's culture, I mean, reading these things, your eyebrows would be, they'd be raised constantly.
Mm-hmm.
He'd be cancelled for the type of I'll put it politely, the type of colonial attitudes he displays in these
yes.
books. Some of the things he said would really, really shock people these days. But he was very, very successful. You see, the thing about Kenya was there was a counterinsurgency, or there was an insurgency or a rebellion by the Mau Mau. Older listeners might remember them. They were, I suppose we compare them to a paramilitary organization, but it was a small war. It wasn't a big war like the Second World War, and this was where Kitson became the expert at what they call counterinsurgency, and he refined and developed techniques that had been around forever, which he then later deployed with further refinements when he came to Ireland,
mm-hmm.
to Belfast. And one of those was what he called pseudo-gangs. And pseudo-gangs were British soldiers who would black up, dress as if they were Kenyans, and they had former Mau Mau guys that they had turned who were now working with them, and they'd be able to go behind the lines, they'd be going to the jungles, they'd be able to ambush people, they'd be able to gather information and then use it to defeat the Mau Mau. And the campaign against the Mau Mau was a success. And after that, our well-travelled Brigadier Kitson goes to Malaya, and
mm-hmm.
it's very much the same situation. And again, the British were fighting the communist Malayan rebellion, and that was also a success. So Kitson became a hero within the British Army, and all of the top soldiers, and one in particular called Lord Carver, who eventually becomes the absolute highest ranking soldier in the British Army, became a tremendous fan of him and even would write reports for his books and things like that in later years. He had one last stop of significance, his few last stops, but he had one last stop of particular significance before he came to Ireland, and that was in the Oman, when he helped put down a rebellion there.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't seem to bother Frank Kitson that slavery was still being practiced. This is go back in the mid-1960s. Slavery was still being practiced in the Oman. People were being thrown into dungeons and that. But anyway, Kitson went ahead and did his job. Briefly came back then before he came to Ireland and worked in an academic position. Took up an he did a thesis which he turned into a book called Low Intensity Operations. And if anybody could have read the draft of that before he arrived in Belfast, they would have had a little bit of a shock, because in the book he points out that the First Standing Army, and I think he's referring to Cromwell's army, the first full-time army, if you like,
mm-hmm.
had been raised to suppress the Irish and mm-hmm. protect the Protestant religion.
Yeah.
Now, he's sent to Belfast in 1970, and the older listeners will remember that the British soldiers, when they went into Northern Ireland first, they were made welcome in the famous cups of tea and
they
sandwiches.
They were, yes.
And, yeah. Mm-hmm. And even as late as December of 1969, there would have been these young soldiers, there would have been 18 or 19 teenagers, really. But they were, even some of them were being invited into houses at Christmas because the local nationalist or Catholic community, there was no real animosity or grief before them.
Indeed.
I won't go into it because it would take too long and it's too detailed. And perhaps as well, people have other views. But I think everybody would agree that as 1970 dragged on, the situation deteriorated and the honeymoon period ended.
Ended, yeah. Wasn't it Paddy Devlin that said of him that he probably did more than any other individual to sour relations between the Catholic community and the British Army in Northern Ireland?
That's absolutely correct. Mm. Absolutely correct. And with the second part, really, of the book, I go into what he did that led to Paddy Devlin saying that later on. And he did try the old hearts and minds thing, and there were committees set up, and there was relationships developed, or attempts to develop relationships between the army and the nationalist communities. And there were good relationships, but unfortunately that didn't last. And then Kitson began to revert to the guy we've seen in Kenya
mm-hmm.
and in Malaya and elsewhere. And remember I said a few minutes ago there that he had developed this technique of blacking up, going
yes.
in with locals, mm-hmm. going behind the lines. Well, he constructed a new unit that became terribly controversial later on called the Military Reaction Force, or the MRF. And they got turned former IRA men, and they were going around Belfast, these guys in unmarked cars, civilian clothes, with non-military issue guns. And they started out as surveillance people, but that later unfortunately escalated into very controversial shootings, people at barricades, and turned out that none of these people were paramilitaries at all. Some of them were just two guys on their way to work. They were mistaken for two well-known bravos, and they were shot. And this is part of the tragedy. When I say Kitson was the wrong man, the wrong place at the wrong time, I discovered declassified documents.
Mm-hmm.
And in them, Kitson describes how he didn't want to fight a war on two fronts. In other words, he didn't want to take on the UDA and the UVF and the Red Hand Commando, because that would have stretched the limit and that would have made his job impossible.
Mm.
And you'll recall there what he'd written in his book about suppressing the Irish and protecting the Protestant religion. Well, it won't be a surprise then that he decided that he was going to take the counterinsurgency war to the nationalists. Now, this is particularly tragic because the job of the British Army was as an aid to the civil power. They were there as an umpire.
Mm-hmm.
But secretly, they started engaging in these activities. And there's lots more. It's all described in the book that they did. And unfortunately, as you've said there, Paddy Devlin and others were aghast at him. And eventually he was pushed out of Belfast earlier than he should have been, but not before other tragedies like the Ballymurphy massacre. It was his troops that carried that out, and we've seen the inquest reports.
Yeah, you were saying there that he was the wrong man in the wrong place there, and I read there about in the House of Commons that he was praised by MP, Tory MP. His name was Philip Goodhart, and he said that Kingston was the right man in the right place at the right time. So he would have been.
Well, I wish I'd had that bit of research for the book. I missed that one. I must take a note of that. That's very interesting. Yeah. Well, in Britain, they don't know what he did in Belfast.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a hero. And like I said, he became the aide-de-camp to the Queen, and he rose up the ranks, and he was very, very successful. So successful, in fact, that he became globally renowned amongst NATO forces, and particularly the Americans, as a counterinsurgency expert, despite the fact that Paddy Devlin's take on his lack of success is the accurate one. He was a disaster, and he made the IRA. I'll come back to that point and develop that, if you like, in a moment. Mm.
Was he ever investigated by the Savile report? Did he come into that?
Well, I'm actually a lawyer, and I was very, very interested in following and watching Savile. Kitson was the second witness to give evidence on Savile sat in London. He didn't give any evidence in Derry at all. The troops that carried out the killing of 13 people and a 14th person died later on, they were one para, the first parachute regiment, and they were under his control, and they were based in Palace Barracks, which is just outside Belfast. And you would have thought that the commander of all the troops in Belfast, including the paratroopers who went and went out of control, would have spent days and days and been grilled. No, he was in the witness for hours, and I believe the questions that were asked of him were not very, very penetrating. And really, the most of my book is taken up by an analysis of what happened on Bloody Sunday, and I respectfully disagree with the findings of Lord Savile. I've found one or two places where he's made absolutely objective, demonstrable, provable mistakes. And I arrive at a different decision on that. Now, everybody gives up about the earlier investigation into Bloody Sunday, which was the Widgery Tribunal. And that was a disgrace, and it was a whitewash. Savile was. I don't accuse Savile of any shenanigans or dishonesty. He came to a conclusion that's respectable. I can disagree with it. He looked at the same evidence as I've looked at, and I've come to a completely different conclusion. So if you like, I'm offering a little bit of a rebuttal to the Savile inquiry, and it's set out over about 100 pages in the book, and it's there for anybody, and particularly families in Derry and that.
Yes.
This is what I think really happened.
Right.
And I don't think it was quite as accidental as Lord Savile made it out to be.
Right. So he served just over 2 years in Northern Ireland, was it?
Well, he was meant to spend 2 years, but he came in September of 70, and he was gone because of the likes of Paddy Devlin and others, because he created by April of 72, so about 18 months.
Yeah, I'm not sure whether Douglas Hurd came in as Northern Ireland Secretary, that he may have been possibly the man behind sending him back to the UK. I could be wrong on that. But he certainly seems to have brought a lot of what he did in the likes of Nairobi, Kenya, Aden, Cyprus. Yeah. He brought it to Northern Ireland.
Yeah, all of these counterinsurgency tactics. Well, the MRF was one particularly good example. And he wrote a book as well about the importance of propaganda. And he picked that up as well in the colonies. Because, sir, he was also in Cyprus as well, and propaganda had been very, very important there, and he learned how to handle the media. And there's a very, very famous journalist, he's retired now, but he used to work for The Guardian, called Simon Winchester. And a few years ago, he described how after the British Army would shoot someone, and it would be very controversial, he would be invited to go out to the headquarters, Tiffel Barracks, where Kitson was based along with headquarters of the British Army in Northern Ireland. And he would be brought in, and Kitson would be there with all his uniform on, and there'd be put Simon Winchester describes as lackeys around him, and they'd be all officious, and they'd be standing up when kids would come into the room and handing them documents and everything. And this was all spoof and palaver. And some poor unfortunate civilian, who's nothing at all to do with any paramilitary group, has just been shot dead, but the British Army didn't want this bad publicity getting out, and particularly wouldn't have wanted to get him back to Britain. So they would bring in this journalist, and they would start telling him that, oh, so-and-so was, lieutenant commander of this group, of that group, or he's an IRA fellow, or he was a gunman. And Simon, much to his later regret, and he writes about this, would then report this. So Kitson was hands-on with that type of propaganda. It was his troops that carried out the Ballymurphy massacre. It was his troops, the secret guys, the MRF guys, that started these undercover shootings that are so controversial. And in the book as well, I go into it, the deepest root I could find of the beginning of collusion between British forces and the UDA. And there's definitely traces there of RUC involvement and military intelligence involvement. And the question I ask is it possible that the top soldier in Belfast, with his background, didn't know about this?
Hardly unlikely.
Still alive. If he wants to come out and deny it, I'd be delighted to debate with him.
He's in his mid-90s now. I think he's around, from what we learned here, he's around 95, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, that's
so he hasn't come out and he's probably not likely to come out and tell all, as it happened.
No. Well, that's very interesting that you brought that up, because he's written about 10 books, and a lot of them are about the people in the Navy. A couple of interesting ones as well. There's one about Cromwell, but he wrote two particular books about his experiences as a counterinsurgency soldier. One in 1961 and 1977. Now, 1977 is 5 years after he left Belfast. And he describes in great detail Kenya, Malaya, Cyprus, Oman, etc. Not a word about Ireland. No doubt that he would have written copious reports. None of them, but with the exception of one or two, none of them have been declassified.
Right.
And unlikely now that they ever will, because when he appeared at the Savile inquiry for his hour and a half, 2 hours, he played the role of somebody who was very unimportant. None of the superiors would have read my books or known anything about me. I just followed orders. I didn't do anything. Mm-hmm. I don't remember the Ballymurphy. I didn't even discuss with my commanders their trip to Derry for Bloody Sunday. So if he comes out now and contradicts that, well, he's going to look like a...
Yeah,
he's not going to look well.
So he's not.
I don't expect he ever will come out. He's being sued, Joe. He's been sued at the moment.
By whom?
In Belfast, in the High Court, by the family of a guy called Patrick Heenan.
Mm-hmm.
Patrick Heenan was killed by a guy called Albert Ginger Baker, who was pleaded guilty later on and was convicted. And it'll be very interesting if that trial ever gets to go ahead in Northern Ireland. You know, all the trouble now about the legislation that the British government is trying to bring in to stop all of these type of prosecutions.
Yeah.
But if that trial were to go ahead and people were to be put in the witness box and cross-examined, I think some very, very interesting things could happen. So we may yet hear a little something from
it. Yeah, it may come to the surface, indeed. Your book is as I say, it's out on the 5th of this month. And
right.
No doubt we can get it in, they always say, all good bookshops, but I'm sure, I don't know why they say that. I mean, every bookshop is a good bookshop. We could pick it up in Easons and bookshops. I actually look forward to it, David, reading it, because it's... the likes of that is right up my alley. I've read some very good books on Northern Ireland over the last couple of years. I was only a young fella when it was all starting out. And like a lot of people my age, we kind of saw it on the TVs, and we've seen all the documentaries on Panorama and World in Action and all that stuff. And it's still interesting to... when the likes of your book comes out. Have you anything else coming up behind on regarding when sorry on Kingston itself? Any other books coming up, or
Well, I did one last year on the arms crisis, myself and Michael Heaney, an RTE journalist. We both came out with books within the 6 month period, and I have one or two other ideas.
Is that
all right for
that's books. The Charlie Hottie book?
Yeah, oh, the Charlie Hottie book. Mine was the revelation that Sean McStephon, the former
IRA commander,
chief of staff,
that
caused a bit of controversy. I was pointing out from three very, very senior Garda sources I'd had that he had been not quite an informer. I'll use the word first of all, informer, but actually what he was doing was he was masquerading as an informer, and he was sending them disinformation and lies and making them look at the official IRA, who were his opponents, while he was secretly building up the provisional IRA, and he was all the time deflecting attention away from his group onto the other group, which eventually wound down and became the Workers' Party. And
yeah,
of course, went on to do what they did. So that book came out last year, and this one is this year. I have one or two ideas all right for books, so this won't be the last one, hopefully.
Yeah, I actually have the Charlie Hottie one, and they'll kill me for saying this. They gave it to me for Christmas, and I haven't got around to reading it yet. I'm reading the John. God, his name won't come to me. BB Radio 4 presenter, excellent book. I'm trying to finish that, and then I'll get on to Charlie Hottie's. But go ahead, David. Sorry.
Well, maybe I've rekindled your interest. But listen, you've been so kind and so good of you to ask me on. I don't want you to go out and buy a copy of this book. I'm going to pop you I have one or two copies here. I'm going to sign it, and I'm going to pop it in the post this afternoon. So I get the address from your research people in a minute. But I'm sure it's on the website.
Yes.
So
well, you're very good.
It'll arrive out.
You're very good.
Day or two.
Yeah.
Oh, not at all. My absolute pleasure. That will be my pleasure, Joe.
Lovely. Okay, David, listen, thanks very much for talking to us. And please, God, we look forward to talking to you again.
Absolutely. I look forward to that as well. Thank you so much.
Take care. Bye now. Bye-bye.
God bless.
Bye-bye. And there we go, guys. That's David Burke and his book is called Kingston's Irish War and the Mastermind of the Dirty War in Ireland. And